Indiana is home to some interesting historical stops and museums, some more odd than others. How does local history live on for Hoosiers through museums and other areas of interest? Today on All In, we'll explore the history of pharmacies, miniature houses, superheroes, and mental health hospitals. I'm Jill Sheridan. Who are the people who cultivate such a passion for preserving history, however strange? How many of these museums and sites become a part of Indiana culture? What does it take to make these spots thrive in the 21st century? If you have a love of preserving, collecting, or archiving, we'd like to hear from you. Comment on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. First, this news. This is All In. I'm Jill Sheridan, in today for host Matt Pelser. Indiana is home to hundreds of museums, historic sites, collections, or archives, and topics can range from Model Ts to Red Skeleton, from teeny tiny statues of Liberty to the county's country's only still working Rotary Jail. How have these locations become entrenched in Indiana communities? Who are the people behind these collections? Have you ever thought of starting a museum? We'd love to hear from you on Facebook or Twitter. Find All In Indiana. Joining me today in the studio is Tamara Hammerline. She's the Director of Local History Services at the Indiana Historical Society. Tamara, thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you for inviting me.
So talk about what you do, because your job is pretty unique.
So the Local History Services Department of the Indiana Historical Society travels all over the state working with organizations that touch history in some way. So museums, historic sites, libraries, if they touch history, we visit them and we work with them on whatever their needs may be. So we do consultations and site visits and have a lot of fun with local history.
I was looking, trying to find a list of how many. I mean, there are hundreds, literally.
There are hundreds. Our mailing list, or a list that we've sort of been able to hone down, identifies somewhere between 900 and 1,000.
Wow.
Organizations that do some kind of history in the state of Indiana.
So this field work that you do, this field service office with the Indiana Historical Society, I mean, it's relatively unique for Indiana.
It is. It is. We exist to provide professional development to our history colleagues or any kind of museum all over the state. So last year, my department traveled something like 20,000 miles inside of Indiana just working with local folks.
It's so much fun. And I bet you have, you know, just a million different stories about what you've experienced while on the road in Indiana.
Oh, absolutely. When we're in local museums, we see all kinds of things. We hear all kinds of amazing stories about the people who lived there, the people who use the objects that are in the museums. We just hear everything.
Well, you give advice about, you know, best practices for people doing this type of work, about funding, about preservation in general. What kind of information do you find that people in Indiana, that Hoosiers do need when they're starting to do this work or continuing to do this work?
We work a lot with folks on collection stewardship, on caring for their objects, whatever they may be, whether they're textiles, the spinning wheel, the rotary telephone. We just give them advice on how best to preserve those objects, and we then expand into preserving the histories around those objects. Because a rotary telephone is a rotary telephone, but if you preserve the story of, say, local party lines or how people use that phone, or, you know, sometimes the way they eavesdropped on their neighbors when they had a party line, that makes the object relevant and meaningful, and it helps you to make connections to what is going on today.
You speak of the, you know, the individual stories that can be tied to, you know, any piece in any museum across the state. What are some of those interesting objects? You were talking about, you know, a pot in Lane Place.
So in Lane Place, in Crawfordsville, Indiana, there's the Harshbarger kettle, which came over with the Harshbargers when they immigrated from Switzerland in the mid-1800s. And the story is that the Hirschberger mother was going up on the ship to gather fresh water, and she had tied the kettle to her apron, and the ship rolled or caught a wave. She fell overboard, and a sailor was able to catch hold of the handle of the kettle with the grappling hook and pull her back on board the ship. And so the story goes, that kettle is the reason there are Hirschbergers in Indiana today.
I love it. The stories that can be tied to, you know, how people start this work, why they're so passionate about it, and how they, you know, keep it on.
Absolutely.
What are some of the more interesting, you know, places that you've worked with in your travels across the state?
Oh, my gosh. We work with so many interesting places that have amazing objects. So one of the places, and frankly, this is not a collections object. It's a horse mannequin, a horse statue, that when the museum was looking at its collection, they wanted to keep it, but they knew it wasn't a historical object. So what they started to do was put this horse statue outside of the museum, and they would dress it up for holidays. And on Valentine's Day, they give it a dating profile. And what they've discovered is folks are coming by the museum to have their pictures taken, and it's somewhat of an unofficial mascot and is becoming a place where people bring their out-of-town visitors to get their picture taken with the dressed-up horse and then visit the museum. And that's at the Daviess County Museum in Washington. So,
have you found that these places and whatever starts them can really, you know, bring communities and people together?
It really can. So what we're seeing now is a lot of local museums, a lot of local organizations really thinking about being places for community discussion, places where they bring people together, multi-generational groups and diverse groups, and they're starting conversations. And a lot of times those conversations start when they're talking about sort of a more distant past, but then they can loop in what's going on today so that they are working to make that past history relevant. You know, and people are getting to share stories, and people are making personal connections through discussions at the museums or through objects that the museums hold.
And the people, you know, is obviously what is making this happen. It takes a lot of volunteer hours and a lot of passion.
It really, really does. And so I encourage people when they go into museums or when they're thinking about visiting, make sure you talk to the people because they have the stories. They can tell you about that building down the street that's now, say, a real estate office, but it used to be the department store. And they can talk to you about what having that department store meant to the community, or visits to the department store, picking out the back-to-school clothes in the, you know, 50s.
Love it. And also, you know, this work, you know, it's not easy, and people come into it in different ways. Do you find, you know, having been in this field for a while, that it's becoming more, you know, resourceful for people to be able to be out there doing this work here today because of what's available to them and because of the interest that people are developing for it?
I think that, you know, people can go online. There are YouTube channels talking about preservation. There are all sorts of places that talk about storytelling and can teach people how to tell stories or how to connect stories to objects. I do think it is becoming easier to preserve the objects that represent the history. There are so many resources out there. And then I think we get emails from folks saying, I've got this wedding dress. What do I do? And when we respond, we can say, so here are some different places. Go online, find this source. And there are sources that are actually sort of geared towards museum professionals, but we can point anybody towards them because as folks who deal with collections and museums and the work of museums, I think we're getting better at talking to people in non-museum-y ways.
Mm, yeah. I have a couple pizzas that, you know, I have in my basement from my grandparents that I would like to, you know, consider donating to a museum. Can anybody, you know, start helping to do this work in the state of Indiana?
So I think one of the things to think about is who owned your pieces, mm-hmm. and sort of where geographically they were used or where they originated, and then contact the historical organizations in those areas and be prepared to tell them the story behind the object. You know, if it's a wedding dress, talk about, say, your grandmother and what her wedding was like and what she was like and what kind of person she was, so that you connect a real person story to an object.
Now, some in Indiana might say that, you know, we're not the strongest in preservation and that, you know, we don't value this. But when you look at, you know, some of the smaller communities and some of the people doing this work, do you find that or do you think that, you know, we do have a special connection to history in the state?
I think that most Hoosiers are very, very passionate about the state's history. And a lot of folks are very passionate about their local history. So at the Indiana Historical Society, we tell the state story and we tell the story of the Old Northwest Territory. And we look at our colleagues across the state to collect those local histories and to help us tell a more local story when we can do that. But really, it's those local folks that are preserving history and are passionate about it and do it in so many wonderful ways.
We're going to be talking to some of those people that are doing it in very wonderful ways and different ways. I mean, it doesn't have to be, you know, history. It can be whatever you're passionate about.
Absolutely.
And you can fall into it in so many different ways in life.
Absolutely.
So we'll be talking to some of those people. And we would also love to hear your stories on Facebook or Twitter. Find us at All in Indiana, because I know there are people out there that are really passionate about this work. As you know, you look forward to some of the work that you're doing here in Indiana and moving around to different communities and stuff. What most excites you about this work?
So generally, we're very busy about 10 months of the year, December and January, not so busy. People have other things and the weather is a little bit iffy in this area. And about the end of January, beginning of February, we get antsy and in local history services, and we say we want to get out there. We want to talk to our folks. We want to see our folks. So we get very, very excited about what people are doing in local history. We want to get on the road. We want to see what they're doing that's new or what they've discovered that's new. And so that is really one of the things that keeps us going, is just every day learning something new about history or talking to people that we hadn't talked to before or catching up with old friends.
And we see some of that, you know, just developing in really interesting ways across the state. We'll be speaking with some people that are, you know, doing this work in ways you probably never thought about. We'll be talking to the founder of the Hall of Heroes Superhero Museum up in Elkhart, the collection manager at the Museum of Miniature Houses, which I do have a miniature house, so maybe I'll talk to her about my collection. And also the founder of Indy's Teeny Statue of Liberty Museum, which has a really interesting story. So I just want to thank you so much, Tamara Hemmerlein, Director of Local History Services at the Indiana Historical Society, for joining us today and giving us an overview on this work that's happening in Indiana.
Thank you for having me.
So up next, we will talk to some museum directors and founders about this work, how they've become involved in their unique or odd collections. And again, we would love to hear from you on Facebook or Twitter. It's All in Indiana. I'm Jill Sheridan, in for host Matt Pelser. Back in 2 minutes, All in. Welcome back to All In. Indiana is home to some odd collections and quirky history. How are Hoosiers cultivating their passion for preservation through these museums? We would love to hear from you on Facebook or Twitter, All In Indiana. Joining me in studio today, Caitlin Rogers from the collection. She's a collection manager at the Museum of Miniature Houses. Thanks, Caitlin, for being here.
Hi, thank you.
Tim Harmon, who's the founder of Indy's Teeny Statue of Liberty Museum. Thank you, Tim, for being here.
Oh, thank you.
And joining us on the phone, Alan Stewart, up in Elkhart, who's the founder of the Hall of Heroes Superhero Museum. Alan, are you there?
I am here.
Thanks so much for joining today. So, Alan, let's start with you. You are the founder of the Hall of Heroes Superhero Museum up in Elkhart, Indiana. This is the home to the largest superhero memorabilia collection in the world. And up until recently, you had everything in your backyard. So large, massive collection. And now you're moving. You know, talk about that process and how that's been for you.
It's a lot of work. it's crazy everything that we've got going on. Originally 13 years ago, I've been collecting for 40 years, been in the industry for 25 years as a comic book historian, writer, and people wanted to see the collection. So 13 years ago, myself and some friends decided, hey, let's build a two-story replica of the Hall of Justice in my backyard, make it a small local museum. And then 7 years ago, Stan Lee came out, filmed his Superfan show at our museum. And as of next week, we will have had 9 national television shows that have filmed at our museum. So it's become this huge national attraction. And we now have like vehicles from Marvel films and costumes and just, so it has to come out of my backyard. So we purchased the building a few months ago. We're in the process of the move right now. We're packing everything up, moving this week. Next week starts set up at the new location, which is up by the Indiana Toll Road on Cassopolis Street. And then our grand opening will be August 31st, Labor Day weekend. And then the weekend after that, we have our Comic-Con about 10,000 people come to every year for that, with the Hollywood celebrities and everything else. So it's pretty hectic right now.
Wow. How has this passion for superheroes, has this passion always been with you?
I've always been passionate about it since I was a kid. I started with, watching the Batman TV show after school and then the Super Friends cartoon and just, I kind of never grew up. I'm kind of like a Peter Pan. I'm almost 50 and I still have like all the toys and the comics and everything. So it's kind of, I like to think it helps keep me young.
You have over 60,000 comics and other, pieces of memorabilia, animation, art, toys. Where do you get all those things?
I'm sorry, what was that last part?
Where do you get all those things?
A lot of the stuff that we get, I've collected for years, and this is, of course, decades before eBay existed, because eBay makes things very easy now, but just going to, garage sales, flea markets, comic book, conventions, and then when eBay came along, eBay. But now we get a lot because we've been a nonprofit organization for 10 years, so we get a lot of people that donate things to us. So we receive a lot of donations here the last several years.
So, Caitlin, I want to ask you, you're the collection manager at the Museum of Miniature Houses in Carmel. Your doors have been open since the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And part of the founding vision is preservation for future generations, as many museums. Can you talk about why that's important to this particular museum?
Preservation is especially important to not only our museum and the collections, but also for miniatures as a hobby. Miniatures was a very popular hobby back in the 70s through the 80s, and it kind of fell off in the 90s and through the early 2000s. But it's ramping up currently. It's changing like many hobbies, which we're really grateful for. But we're preserving also the history of miniature making and the evolution of it through dollhouses, tin houses, doll making, and all the way up into what we consider miniature houses.
So, talk a little bit about more what's in the collection. I know you have some specific historical pieces as mm-hmm. well that are highlighted.
We do. When we opened our doors in 93, we had only 38 objects, and we have grown up to over 6,000. We have everything from traditional dollhouses to the pressed steel tin houses, plastic furniture that they were toys in the 60s, and we also have dedicated miniatures, which would be scaled versions of actual houses.
No, I mean, you don't find miniature, home museums everywhere. This is pretty unique.
Yeah, we're lucky to be one of only 5 museums in the country dedicated to miniatures and miniature making.
What do you love about it?
I love the idea of getting to play with these objects. I get the benefit of kind of owning my own home through them. I get to continue playing dollhouse with these things, but also get to create really unique scenarios with these objects and tell a needed narrative through these objects.
Tim Harmon, founder of Indy's Teeny Statue of Liberty Museum. Now, your story is pretty unique as well, how you became, you know, a museum founder. Tell us a little
really?
Bit.
Really? Well, I don't know. It's unique. I think everybody collects something.
That's true.
And if you collect something, then your mother doesn't know what to get you for your birthday, so she starts giving you marbles or smash pennies or Statues of Liberty, and then your sisters and then your cousins, and people just start giving you stuff. You fill up a shelf, then you fill up a bookshelf, you know, and then you ultimately start putting stuff in boxes, which is no fun at all. And then, you know, you don't even know what you have. So I had a lot of stuff in boxes, and I didn't know how much or what I had, but I did. So and we own an antique store on East 10th Street, and we had an empty storefront. And I asked my partner, I'd like to open a Statue of Liberty Museum in part of that building. And she said, yeah, sure, go ahead. So not knowing exactly how many we had, we set about painting the room and putting up shelves and designing a teeny museum. It's only 15.5 by 9.5.
There's us.
Yeah. Yeah. But when we had everything displayed that we could find, we still have several boxes of things we haven't found. We had 356 pieces. So that was, and we spread it out enough to make it look like it was presentable. Now we have over 600 pieces. We've been open about 3.5 years.
And talk a little bit about, you know, the plethora of pieces that are in there.
Yeah, yeah, the range of what are we talking about? We're talking about Statues of Liberty Museum. We're talking about small souvenirs that you would have gotten in New York City had you gone the turn of the century, the 30s, all the way up until today. Recently, we received a pot holder from New York. That's a new souvenir. We have a lot of smelt kind of statues. These are like pot metal little statues. Some of them are electrified. Some of them aren't electrified. We have a condom in the shape of the Statue of Liberty. That came from Amsterdam. It's a very popular item. We have socks. We have a Barbie doll designed by Bob Mackie.
Oh.
That's an official statue, you know, an official Statue of Liberty Barbie.
So even in your collection, I mean, you know, there is historical significance, and we find that, you know, when people do start these collections, these archives, you know, that they are, you know, connections to history. Is that important for you?
Well, you know, the Statue of Liberty is really important to probably a lot of people, not just Americans, but a lot of people, and it was, you know, it was. Completed, built, installed in 1886, so 100 and some years ago. Gustav Eiffel of Eiffel's Tower designed the ironwork that supports it. It's really interesting. The torch and the hand traveled on train car for years before the statue was actually installed, traveled around the country raising money for the pedestal and the base and the island and all that kind of stuff. We have pieces that old. We have pieces from 1890
cool. In
the museum. Yeah,
we certainly just visited the Statue of Liberty, and that was the first thing on the list, you know, with the kids. And
good for you. I haven't been to the statue.
You're kidding.
Nah.
Put that on the bucket list.
Yeah.
Alan is... is it important for you, you know, the superhero museum, you know, this particular genre? I mean, you know, while it is fairly new, it is still, you know, really important to preserve this history as well.
I think a lot of people don't realize the historical significance of comic books because a lot of people are thinking, oh, well, you know, the big superhero movies have only been out like 10 or a dozen years or so. but they don't realize that comic books played an important part of history and goes back actually 80 years to the first appearance of Superman in 1938 and then Batman in 1939. And it just, you know, a lot of people don't realize that. And then during World War II, you know, more soldiers read comic books than the kids did. So it played a very important role historically. You know, Captain America was the most important, so, you know, comic book character that soldiers read. You know, they could relate to him because he wasn't bulletproof like Superman. He only had the shield to protect him, you know, from bullets. So there's a lot of historical significance to the comic books.
Mm-hmm. And Caitlin, as well, when you're looking at, you know, miniature houses, obviously we talked a little bit about that history. But, you know, what do people say and are they connected to miniature houses and miniature pieces? And do you find that people, you know, make that connection that's important as well?
Absolutely. When people come in and they see our actual miniature houses, they're a little intimidated. They're very curious about the unique hobby, but then they go and see our dollhouses and dolls and toys and furniture and things like that, and they make a connection. Like, I played with this when I was younger, or my mother had this collection when she was a child. So it's great to see that connection to people, that it's not that far removed.
And we would love to hear from you if you're passionate about collecting, archiving, Facebook or Twitter. All in Indiana is where you can find us. We know that, you know, communities do get excited about the work that you're doing, about seeing these collections. Are you finding that more and more people, when they, you know, find out about you, are interested in donating to you, Tim?
Oh, yeah, people are very generous. People do stop by all the time. and bring us cool things that they've found. We have over, you know, we went from 360 pieces to 600 and more. I think we have room for probably about another 600 without moving to a slightly bigger room.
Yeah, that'd be tough because the location's pretty awesome too.
Yeah, and it's tiny.
And Alan, how about you? Are you getting donations from, you know, people when they hear about your story, you know, again, on a national level? I mean, what sort of response do you get from people? And do you appreciate that or accept donations?
We gladly accept donations. In fact, we will have people that bring us, like, old toys or comic book collections. And in fact, it's funny, a couple of months ago, I had a gentleman from Michigan brought 19 long boxes of comic books. It was about 6,000 comic books. And we're a 501c3, so it's, you know, a lot of people find that it's more beneficial financially to donate to us than to, you know, try to sell them and get 5 to 10 cents on the dollar. And it was great because the guy brought all these comic books, and his wife came with him, and she thanked me several times for taking these. And it's like, well, no, thank you. It helps us raise money for, like, our new move and the renovation of our new building and things like that. So we get stuff that comes in all the time. Last week we had a guy from Minnesota mailed us 8 long boxes of Mad magazines.
And Caitlin, I want to talk to you about a donation I have for the museum.
Okay.
It's sitting in my basement. But you know, people do, they make connections to these places, and people from all over the world, you know, are more people. Do you get international visitors to the miniature museum?
We absolutely do. Carmel's in the great location because of all the international headquarters, and we are lucky enough to get international visitors. We have had items sent to us internationally as donations, and we're very grateful for that as well.
I think there's also the teeniest art gallery in Carmel right down the street from you, I believe.
Yes. Yeah.
Another just sort of side note.
I haven't seen that.
How about you? Are you seeing visitors from all over?
Yeah, we've had families from Sweden. We had grandparents and grandkids and the parents. We've had families from Germany, several countries in Africa. And all over the United States and Canada, of course, you know. People, I think people, you know, sitting at home and they read about the museum and they can't wait to call their travel agent, like, get me 2 tickets to Indianapolis, you know. I got to see this thing. And they come, and the tour takes 10 minutes or so, you know.
So they got plenty of other opportunities throughout the day.
Then they get plenty of time to go get lunch in the neighborhood or something. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And Alan, I mean, you're, again, you know, with some of this exposure that you've had, I would imagine that you're hearing from people from all over and how that creates, you know, a greater sense of community for Elkhart, Indiana. And do you sense that?
Yeah, we get a lot of international visitors as well, just as you'd mentioned from a lot of the TV shows that have filmed here. Stan Lee has filmed at our museum. His show is an international show. Richard Rawlings from Gas Monkey Garage Fast and Loud has filmed here. Toy Hunter on Travel Channel. You know, we get a lot of people. In fact, last week was the last week we were open, and we had just last week people, a couple groups from Australia, one group from Finland. So we do get a lot of international visitors here.
And do you find that, you know, that for Elkhart, you know, that just having you there really, you know, builds community?
It does. We've had a lot of support, you know, here locally. We've actually, the last couple of years that we've been putting it out there that we've been trying to move, we've had offers from different, you know, much larger cities, obviously, than Elkhart, because Elkhart's not very big, you know, wanting us to come there because they realize what a tourist attraction our museum would be, because the superhero movies are the big summer blockbusters and everything else. So, you know, people like want to capitalize on that, other cities do. But we decide to stay here and work it out until we get to make it work and stay here. And we've had a lot of community support to make that happen.
I just think it's so interesting, you know, having these unique and odd collections and how they tie into the greater, you know, story of the history of Indiana. So thank you all for being here today. Tim Harmon, founder of Indy's Teeny Statue of Liberty Museum, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
And Caitlin Rogers, collection manager at the Museum of Miniature Houses up in Carmel. Caitlin, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Alan joining us today by phone from Elkhart, Alan Stewart, founder of the Hall of Heroes Superhuman Museum. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you.
Next on All In, we'll be talking with Sarah Halter, Executive Director of the Indiana Medical History Museum, and we'll also take a trip to the fair to visit another museum with historical ties. That's all in 2 minutes on All In. I'm Jill Sheridan, in for host Matt Pelser. Welcome back. Today on All In, we're talking about interesting Indiana history and museum sites. I'm Jill Sheridan, in for host Matt Pelser. Do you know an area of interest, or are you starting your own collection? We welcome your comments on Facebook and Twitter. Find us at All In Indiana. And joining me in studio right now, Sarah Halter, who's the executive director of the Indiana Medical History Museum. Sarah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
The museum, if someone has not visited yet, you know, they need to get there right away because it's really a remarkable piece of Indiana history.
I agree.
And one of a kind. I mean, it's located on the grounds of the former Central State Hospital, which closed back in the mid-90s. But its history goes way back to the mid-1800s, when it was known as the Indiana Hospital for the Insane. So your building is one of the only original buildings left standing. Tell us a little bit of history, how the museum came to be.
Okay. Well, the building is a little bit later than the original hospital. The original hospital opened in 1848, and it was in line with the ideas of the moral treatment movement. So it was this kind of an asylum reform effort that came out of some humanitarian reform efforts led by the Quakers, and a new idea in medicine that mental illnesses were illnesses that could be studied and treated like others could. So by the 1890s, they were starting to realize that that system wasn't very effective. And George Edenharder, who became superintendent of the hospital in 1893, decided to establish the pathological department there to study physical causes of mental diseases so they could better understand them and actually develop effective treatment. So the building opened in 1896. It was cutting edge. It got a lot of national attention for being one of the most modern labs in the country, and it was only the second in the country to apply pathology to mental diseases. It was super modern, lots of new technologies and new sciences being applied, But over the next couple of decades, there was no money to modernize as new technologies became available. So when the building closed as a lab in 1968, all of the original furnishings and equipment, specimens, all of that were still left intact. And so within a year, it reopened as a museum.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Talk about some of the, you know, exhibits and the really interesting artifacts that you have in the museum.
Well, the building is very intact. We operate like a house museum. We do guided tours, and it's a very immersive experience with all of that original stuff. We have three clinical laboratories, bacteriology, histology, and clinical chemistry. We have a medicinal plant garden. We have a medical library, an autopsy room, an anatomical museum. So all of these rooms are still intact, and you can tour through them on the tours.
And you get donations as well. I was just thinking last time when I toured with you, you know, we had a really cool cabinet with that was donated from Lilly, I believe, where a lot of artifacts that were taken out of patients. I mean, just a lot of interesting things in the museum.
Yeah, that came from Riley. Yeah,
Riley.
The foreign bodies cabinet. those are things that were collected from patients. They were things that were, you know, people choked on them or they swallowed them and they had to be surgically removed, and they were kept from the 1920s until the 1970s in this cabinet.
A little bit off track, I'm sure. But, you know, the pathology building is on the National Register of Historic Places. The building itself is also just really important when we're looking at the preservation efforts here in Indianapolis. But, you know, the place itself is so tied to Indianapolis history. And do you find that, you know, the community members have a really special tie to the museum, and that's so important part of the preservation process?
We have noticed that, yeah. The hospital didn't close until 1994, so there are a lot of people around who remember it. I remember it. I grew up on the near west side of Indianapolis, and I remember, you know, I was, I think, maybe a freshman in high school the year that it closed, and so I have very vivid memories of driving by and seeing patients, you know, standing around on the grounds or coming up to the fence. So there are a lot of people who have various connections to the hospital, the neighborhoods around it, people who used to work there, former patients, people whose family members were patients. So everywhere I go, when I tell people where I work, you know, they just have all these stories to tell about their memories of the site and of the people that they knew there.
Do you think it's fair to say that, you know, you ended up doing this work in part because of your connection to the place?
I think so. I started working there a little over 12 years ago now. I was an intern there during grad school, and I just I really felt a connection to the place. I loved the building, and I loved the history there. It's a very complicated history, but a very important and very relevant history for us today. And it's just a really easy place to fall in love with. It's so unique.
It is really important when we're looking back and then looking forward, and we're talking about mental health care.
Right.
What is, you know, what can we learn from this type of unique historical museum?
One of the things that we've done in recent years is really try to focus on the patients themselves. Those are the people for whom the hospital existed. They're the people who, you know, the doctors and administrators and attendants and all the staff, you know, were trying to help. They were the people who also, unfortunately, felt the brunt of the negative stuff when things went wrong. There were always allegations of abuse and neglect. You know, the hospital was perpetually overcrowded and underfunded, so there were a lot of problems, too, and it was the patients who felt most of that impact. So remembering them and their lived experience and giving them a voice that they didn't have in life has been really important for us in the last few years.
Yeah, and I know that you have been doing that work. Talk a little bit about, you know, some of the programs that you've been able to, you know, launch through that work. I know.
Well, we started in 2016 with a series of programs called Voices from Central State. We commissioned a play that was based on the memoir of a patient who was at Central State Hospital in the 1880s. We also did an exhibit about the closure of the hospital from the patient's perspective that was based on newsletters that they wrote internally from about 1988 until the hospital closed. And then we started a project in 2015 to research the patients who are represented in our specimen collection and to learn their human stories and change the way we display and interpret those specimens so that we're not just telling clinical stories of tumors and lesions, and we're telling who these people were and what their lives were like.
And your collection does include tumors and lesions.
It does.
It's a little bit odd, you know. What sort of reaction do you get from people that had no idea that Indiana had this type of museum?
Yeah, it's funny for me. And I never get tired of seeing people's initial reactions. I've been there so long that it feels normal to me. It's just my everyday life. So sometimes I'm a little surprised at people's reactions. But I think people find it incredibly interesting. I think people, I hear people reading descriptions on the labels, and they start talking to each other about, Aunt Sally had that disease, or Uncle Joe was a patient at Central State Hospital, and so really trying to relate those stories to their own lives and their own families, and I think that's really interesting. And then some people, are a little unnerved by some of the specimens, and that's okay too.
Do you think it's important, this type of preservation work when we're really trying to, look forward and understand, mental health?
I do. I think for us and for me personally, I think this on another level is also about combating stigma and fostering compassion and respect. We can't combat stigma if we can't have an open and honest discussion about something. And so I think telling the stories of these patients and being really open and honest about what did happen at the hospital and also what didn't happen, because there are a lot of stories around that just aren't based in fact, and acknowledging the good and the bad, I think is really important.
Well, I encourage anyone that has not visited to please make a visit. Sarah Halter, Executive Director of the Indiana Medical History Museum, thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. Today.
Next up, we're going to be headed out on a field trip, actually, someplace that you might have visited before, the Hooks Museum.
Oh, lovely.
Another medical history.
Tis the season.
Yeah, right? We visited the fairgrounds to see this unique building as well. The house is a collection that's related to Indiana's medical and pharmacy history.
It's a wonderful place.
It is. Bob Hunt is a retired nurse and a Lilly employee, retired, and now he volunteers at the Hooks Museum, and he gave us a tour.
Okay, well, obviously you're on the Indiana State Fairgrounds, and we are in
Thank
the Hooks
you.
Drugstore yeah. Museum and Soda Fountain, and this particular exhibit has been here originating in 1966. Originally, we were a special celebration exhibit for the sesquicentennial of Indiana. And a lot of people don't remember that we celebrated in 1966 the 150th anniversary of statehood back then. I'm old enough, I actually remember that. A lot of the corporations around the state were asked to how could they help celebrate or talk about the history of Indiana, and Hook Drug Company, which was a very large, dominant regional chain in Indiana and Indianapolis, a lot of our older listeners will remember at that time, they said, well, what we would like to do is create a museum to celebrate the history of pharmacy and care and drugstores in Indiana.
The collection is beautiful, and the first thing that you notice when you come in is these cabinets. Talk a little bit about, I know a lot of these items in this building were sourced from all over the state.
Yes, this is largely a Hoosier collection. Let me say first that these are probably some of the finest 19th century drugstore cabinets anywhere in the country today preserved. And they originally were made in Cincinnati, Ohio, at a time before even trains had started regular service across Indiana. So how do you get these huge, beautiful drugstore cabinets from Cincinnati, Ohio, all the way up to Cambridge City, Indiana, where they're booming on the national road? Well, you float them up on the brand new transportation system that's taking the country by storm. It's called the canal system, okay? All the way from Cincinnati to Cambridge City, Indiana, and installed there in a pharmacy that had been started by Sam Hoshauer and a gentleman named Calloway. You mentioned walking through those doors. I would like to mention just quickly that we have very good records that go back all the way to 1966, and we know how many people come in here. Believe it or not, there's been an estimated 4 million people that have stepped over that threshold since 1966. That makes that not only a popular exhibit, it probably makes Hooks, the museum here at the Indiana State Fair, the most visited drugstore venue antique museum of its type in the entire nation, and puts us right up there in the entire world, because many times these exhibits are kind of in places where they're not very well visited. We have over 60,000 people every year who walk through those doors.
Incredible. Talk a little bit about some of the artifacts here, because I've seen people in this museum before just marveling at the amount of things. And it really also drives home how much medicine has changed.
So here you can see this would be the pharmacy's workspace. So the pharmacist would get prescriptions, and he would sit back here and compound the prescriptions from this point here. And if he needed additional materials, he could source them out here where he had some of his more bulk supplies. But he would sit back here. He could keep an eye on everything that was going on in the store. But this basically was set up to keep people, say, hey, don't bother me. I'm busy here. I've got to do my work.
Do you have any idea how many bottles and containers are in the store?
So currently we are digitizing our entire collection. Our future hope is to eventually have our collection online. If we do so, we'll be the first large major pharmacy drugstore collection online anywhere. Right now we're up to, I think it's about 3,000 or 4,000 items, and we've just worked our way down that side point. So I think if you just looked in this main room here, you're probably talking at least 4,000 plus individual items.
And a lot of items that are, you know, unique to what medicine was like then. What stands out to you? What bottles are you in love with?
It's hard not to love a bottle that's labeled satanic laxative. and certainly, or maybe you'd rather prefer the asthma cigarettes. So we have a lot of things that seem very ironic. But I think the most ironic thing to me is I can go over there off the shelf of our what we would call our ready-made side, where you can just pull a bottle, you're going to sell them that bottle. And the most outrageous, crazy claim that I can find over there, I could probably go out on the internet today and I could find in a couple of minutes that somebody's going to sell me that same thing with that same claim as a dietary supplement. Unfortunately, we as a people always want to believe there's a magic bullet out there, that we want to believe that there's something that's going to cure us without high cost, without high risk. And people today are exactly like people 120 years ago. They want to believe.
Let's walk over to the soda bar. I know this piece was also sourced from a different area in Indiana.
The soda bar itself, the back bar, actually comes from Sunman, Indiana, I believe. And it was donated to us. The most interesting part probably, now that our what you see is our marble soda fountain is actually a mock-up. So it's not in use. It's basically just something that we show. But that particular marble soda fountain, believe it or not, when it was found by the gentleman that was furnishing this store, it was being used in a woman's backyard as a garden planter. But soda fountains have a long association with the pharmacies. We first became able to place carbonation in water. There are some sources where water is naturally carbonated coming out of the ground. People were fascinated with that. They saw it as a medicinal. And so they figured out pretty quickly how to artificially carbonate water. And so pharmacists were selling carbonated water very, very early on in pharmacies as just part of their medicinals. And because medicines back then tasted terrible, there was an old saying, if it didn't taste bad, it wouldn't have any effect, right? Pharmacists became expert at flavoring their medicines and making them taste a little better so people would take them.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was out of the Indiana State Fairgrounds, taking a tour of Hooks Museum. The fairgrounds, of course, running right now. You can go out and see that building, which also has a unique history. The building used to host the Better Babies contest back in the day when That was a thing. It's a show today about odd and original historical sites in the state of Indiana. And I want to thank so many great guests that came on today. We heard from the Indiana Medical History Museum, of course, Indy's very own teeny Statue of Liberty Museum. We heard from the manager over at the Museum of Miniature Houses and the Hall of Superheroes Museum, which is up in Elkhart, Indiana, and how you as well can get involved in this historic preservation and interesting museum history. You just never know when you're going to fall right into it. Thank you so much for joining us today on All In as we explored some of these places. Hopefully you can start visiting some of these areas that are in your own backyard. You never know. I'm Jill Sheridan, in today for host Matt Pelser, who is on paternity leave, but will be joining us again after next week. Next time on All In, we will talk about mass transportation in Indiana, successes, some of the struggles communities in the state have seen, and also the future, what that might look like. Thank you so much for listening. This is All In.